Hi, folks. Welcome back to the show. Very excited to have my guest on today. A congressman here in the United States for 19 years, Speaker of the House for 4 years from 1995 to 1999. He's a best-selling author of several books, including his current book, Collusion. Newt Gingrich, it's great to have you on, sir.
Well, I'm delighted to be on, and I think that it's a very exciting thing to have a chance to talk about collusion.
Yeah.
It really deals with the reality of Russia. And I think that's important for the American people to come to grips with.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because it raises a lot of the significant issues that we're dealing with right now. Are they our ally? Are they our enemy? Are leftist activists susceptible to influence from abroad? Was this a happy coincidence, or did you come up with this idea for the book based on what we're currently dealing with and have been dealing with since the 2016 election regarding Russia?
Well, I had the data came out as a real coincidence. We had no idea a year ago, talking with our publisher, when Mueller's report would come out. So in that sense, it's just random luck. But the concept goes all the way back to the early stages of the Mueller investigation, because we were convinced that there was no collusion involving Trump. But we also knew, as historians, and Pete Early had written, who's my co-author, had written three books, one with the highest KGB officer ever to defect, one about the Walker family who were spies for the Russians, and one about another spy. And so we had a good background of knowing that there were people who colluded with the Russians. Robert Hansen, for example, for over 25 years was a spy while being a leading FBI agent. And Ames was a spy at the CIA for about 20 years. So the background was there to talk about what would happen if you had a Russian-American collusion underway. And then when the Russians last year tried to poison the defector in Great Britain, we were reminded of how much the Russians love to use poison and how much they like to use poisons that you can trace back to them so they can use it as an agent, as an element of fear. And that's a key part of what was going on. So we put that together into the plot that you see in our novel Collusion. And I think, finally, we want to make it very modern. So our key character, Brett Garrett, is a Navy SEAL who was severely injured in a helicopter crash during a combat mission and ended up using opioids for pain treatment and then became addicted, and is really trying to wrestle with his addiction while still being productive and effective. And we thought that made it very relevant to the modern world.
Yeah, it's something that really stood out. You really sort of have some touchstones in terms of issues that are the country's grappling with, not just politically, but even the opioid addiction. It was very, very clever and very well done. And you have a Putin-like president in the book. And I was curious, you know, obviously being a leader in this country for a lot of years yourself, how sophisticated is this Putin regime vis-a-vis regimes in the past that preceded him? It seems to be, I guess maybe he takes his KGB experience, which allows him to take his treachery, if you will, to another level. But how sophisticated is this regime with him in charge versus those that preceded him?
I would say, in understanding the modern world and using modern technology, he may be the most effective leader the Russians have had in terms of using limited power very, very intelligently. This is a guy who was a KGB colonel, helped control the people of East Germany. He has all of the characteristics of being willing to torture, to kill, to do what is necessary that you would expect from a trained professional KGB agent. And I think that he has actually, with a relatively weak economy and a relatively weak power projections, have been remarkably good at being able to maneuver and give Russia some opportunities it wouldn't have had otherwise.
Yeah. You know, you worked into the book Congressional Infighting, which obviously I'm sure you know a lot about. How does that play into the book, and why was that important for you to kind of work that into the book?
Well, we wanted to communicate the realities of our two systems. And the fact is that a lot of the time, the United States is made less effective by partisanship and by the kind of bureaucratic behaviors that drive you crazy if you're trying to get something done. And we wanted to show people, you know, how really hard it is to move states in the United States and how many different activities you have to engage in. I mean, Putin basically has a real dictatorship where if you openly criticize him, you just get killed. We have a society where even at the very top, we have people who sometimes can't work with each other and can't get anything done.
And are we disadvantaged as a country, as a general rule, because of, you know, that it's like anything in life, there's two sides to the coin. The great thing about democracy in a republic is, you know, you have both sides and there's debate and there's, but as you seem to be alluding to, there's also a tendency to create inactivity. Whereas if you're a dictator, ruthless or otherwise, you can move quickly. Are we as a country, in your experience, always at a disadvantage in some way because of that, vis-a-vis these countries that sort of can move quickly through dictatorship?
No, I think there's a huge long-term advantage to being able to think things through, have to debate them. We tend to make better big decisions, but we're not as efficient at implementing small decisions. So if you look in the short run, dictatorships have certain kinds of advantages, but if you look in the long run, they give up a lot of those advantages because they make bigger mistakes and they're dramatically less capable than a democracy is. And I think the self-correcting nature of a democracy is an enormous advantage in the long run.
Mm. What was that transition like for you, going from a congressman to Speaker of the House, taking on that mantle? Was it just, obviously, I would imagine things you didn't expect? Was it incredibly more complicated than you thought it would be? Speak to that a little bit. I'm interested in hearing about that experience for you.
Well, I think that it you have to recognize that you have a different role. When you're the Speaker of the House, you are the third-ranking person in line to be president. You're the only legislative branch person mentioned in the Constitution. You have a duty, I think, to try to think about the whole country, not just think as a partisan. And I think you have to take that seriously. My dad served 27 years in the U.S. Army and was very passionately committed and dedicated to America. And I tried to take his attitude of service and apply it to what I was doing. I thought it was very, very important that we had that kind of attitude. That we walked up, you know, I wanted to walk in every morning and ask, what is it we can do good for America? And I think that was a very important part of how we operated and what we tried to get done.
How hard was it and is it to get things done with the other side, you know, in the sense of, you know, I would imagine every day you wake up in that role, you've got to be thinking about, okay, I would compromise or working, you know, effectively with people who may differ in terms of theoretical views, philosophical views, political views. How much of your time was spent just sort of managing that process?
Oh, a lot. I mean, if you're serious about getting something done, you have to spend a lot of your time thinking about the other side. And it's a very simple principle. What is it they need and what is it they can't do?
Right.
And what is it that we need and what is it that we can't do? And is there a box there in the middle where we can get something done? And Clinton and I spent, I think, 35 days negotiating the balanced budget. I mean, the only time in your lifetime the federal budget was balanced for four straight years, Clinton and I did it. Mm-hmm. That took us literally sitting in a room face to face, talking through issues, you know, day after day after day until we got it to work.
Was it harder to get the other side to see your views or to get those in your party to come along with you regarding something that they felt was antithetical to what they believed in?
Now, you know, that's actually a great question. And I would say that it depended. There were times when you had to go to your own members and say, look, this is the best we're going to get. And we can either decide to get nothing or we can decide that this is pretty good. But we're not going to get more than this. And, you know, some of the members would always say, well, that's not enough. And I routinely would have a handful of members who just wouldn't go along. I mean, they would just say, no, you know, I think we can do better than that. I don't think you're doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at that point, you sort of have to respect their right to disagree with you. But at the same time, it sometimes gets very frustrating and you think, you know, give me a break.
Yeah.
But that's just also part of the business, you know, and you have to have this kind of attitude that you're comfortable having people who are willing to disagree with you, even if they're on your side. They still are independent agents elected by their own constituency, and they still have a right to have their own views.
Yeah. And that's healthy. That's healthy to have those debates internally and on your side, as well as with people from the other side. You know, I think one of the things that I think really allows you to stand out is you took a different approach in leading the party, in being a House leader, that sort of contradicted the conventional wisdom of politics. Was, you know, there was a time when Democratic politicians on the state and local level were tied to the National Democratic Party and Clinton, and would, you know, I ultimately moved to the center to get larger numbers of voters behind them. But it seemed like you and your allies believe that an organized effort to like intensify sort of contrast between Republicans and Democrats and almost move Republicans not to the center but more to the right was more in a more effective way, especially regarding the South and inroads there. How did you come up with that approach? It's obviously seemed to work very effectively. And I know you're a professor of history. What did you see in the landscape that thought, okay, well, this can work against what normally works?
Well, partly it was simply having campaigned with and worked with Ronald Reagan, first when he was a candidate, and then when he was president, and watched him do it. I mean, Reagan understood that there were core values of the American people. A good example is the work ethic. Now, most Americans, the vast majority of Americans, believe in work, and they think you should work. They think it's good. They think it's healthy to work. Well, you know, if you're a good, solid liberal, you may not believe that. You may think, oh, gee, you know, I just commented on this morning's new job numbers, which are amazing. That if, you know, if you're a good liberal, you're thinking, oh, all those people are now going to get off food stamps. And they're going to get out of public housing. So if you're a good socialist, you sort of think it's a defeat to have the United States have this kind of a great turnout. But in fact, if you are anybody else, you think it's a great thing. Mm-hmm. If we're in a position where we can have more and more people working on their own, taking home their own salary, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of it. And I had a feeling that the American people were more prepared for conservative solutions like welfare reform than the Washington establishment did. And so that's a key part of our success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sort of tying into what really matters to people. Just circling back to the book for 1 minute, you also, as I mentioned, you know, you've touched on a lot of relevant issues in society right now. And the media plays a part in the book and the ability to differentiate between the good guys and the bad guys. And how did you explain how you kind of use the media in the book and what sort of message, if any, you're trying to put out there about the media?
Well, I don't think you can have a really honest modern novel that doesn't reflect the scale of power of the news media and the degree to which some parts of that power are destructive. And so I thought if we're going to write an honest novel, we'll really look at how the modern world works. You had to include that as part of the story.
Yeah, it's become a big part of our culture now. It's a very powerful part of what we do as Americans, and especially with a 24-hour news cycle. Well, the book is really, really interesting and really relevant on a lot of levels. It's called Collusion. It's out now. Folks can get it pretty much everywhere. And it's really been great talking to you. You're someone that has had a big impact on the country, and really interested to hear how you kind of approached leading and all of that. And really appreciate having you on, and wish you best of luck with the book as well.
I'm delighted. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and I want to thank you. I thought you had some really, really good questions.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. I try. I'm going to tell my wife so she's proud of me. enjoy your travels, and hopefully we can talk again in the future. We'd love to have you back on.
Great. Look forward to it.